I'll let everyone know we're going live as well.
We are live. It is another show. Good Friday show. So 18th of April, 2025. And we've got a bit of a camping trip this weekend. But we decided to hang around and give you this stream regardless because it's been a interesting week in Australian politics. And there's quite a bit to break down. So, yeah, we've got a few things we want to discuss with you. So we've got a show for you this evening. Blair, how you feeling?
I'm finally feeling better. I was so sick, man, this last 5-6 days. Really sick. Some, I don't know, engineered superbug. I don't want to describe the details because it wasn't very nice. But I would rather die than go through what I went through again. It was really bad. I noticed, thanks guys, by the way, I lost about 50 or 60 subscribers from my Telegram channel because I was too sick to post anything for a few days. Good to know my followers aren't so fickle. But I'm just glad to be feeling normal again. When I get sick, I sadly look at photos of myself when I wasn't sick. And I'm just like, God, I didn't know how lucky I was to just feel normal. But yeah, you don't know what you got till it's gone. But I'm glad I'm back. I'm feeling fine. I can digest everything again. So yeah, but look, man, I've never had anything like that before in my life. What I just experienced, when I get sick, it's not for 5 days like that. It's usually like an overnight thing. Maybe I need 1 day to recalibrate. What do you think, Joel? Do you think we're suffering new diseases, new bugs that the skilled labor is bringing into Australia?
Yeah, I remember referring to your ailment as a Jeet virus when discussing it with someone who asked how you were doing, that you've been afflicted with one of these new Jeet viruses, because it seems like what it was. I myself have gotten one or two pretty bizarre stomach bugs over the past 6 months. And so have many other people in the community and in my family. And everyone described the symptoms as something that they've never felt before. Like this wasn't like a regular like gastro type thing. And that's the only explanation, is that the immigrants are bringing in strange new viruses. And obviously they have maybe more of an effect on us than they do on them because they're more attuned, like adapted to them or something. But yeah, what you described sounded absolutely horrible. So
didn't we do the same thing to the Aboriginals? We brought influenza into Australia, which wiped out a significant fraction of them because they weren't accustomed to those diseases or viruses. Is that true?
I mean, I believe so. I think.
No, do you know, I heard in a higher education institution a theory by one of the Aboriginal studies people who apparently get in on every course and every subject that anyone's studying in order to pass psychology subjects, mental health, cooking. You generally have to also complete the Aboriginal awareness cultural program that's taught to you by some Aboriginal government bureaucrat. And she said in this course that I tried to do a few years ago that there's a theory that the British deliberately brought influenza in jars, knowingly and deliberately, to release it onto the Aboriginal communities to commit some sort of chemical warfare, some sort of preconceived plan to nuke them with chemical warfare. It's not confirmed, of course, but she raised that in I think it was a Cert 4 or a diploma that I was in. And there were all these, like, you know, 18, 19-year-old kids out of uni and people of different ages just kind of swallowing it. Just nodding along, listening to her say that to them. It makes you wonder what kind of like rumors and bullshit stories are they spreading in education institutions regarding the genocide of Aboriginals.
Yeah. Well, anyway, let's get into some of the meat, I guess, of the stream. I put out an opinion piece on the Noticer yesterday. And it was intentionally a little bit provocative about the election coming up. And I made the point that in Australia, because we have a preferential voting system, where you basically order all the candidates from your first to last preference. That what's interesting basically about voting is, in some ways, what's more interesting, you could even say in some respects, is who you're putting last rather than who you're putting first. Like, who are you voting against rather than voting for? In an election when there isn't that many good candidates to vote for, and anyone who's pretty decent doesn't have a very good chance at winning. Although I did say, you know, I think if you're in Queensland, maybe Gerard Renner can get elected to the Senate, and he did stand up to the Jews and so on recently. So I hope he does get elected, but putting him aside and I guess a few other minor party candidates, you know, the government is going to be shit regardless of what happens. So I guess what's more interesting is who are you voting against? And the position that I took is that we should put the Liberals last, even below the left-wing parties, simply to punish them for being so horrible. And also just in the recognition that they aren't just horrible this time, but the Liberals have a track record over the last 50 years of basically functioning as a left-wing party. It was the Liberal government in the 1970s under Fraser that adopted multiculturalism officially as government policy for the first time. It was the Liberal government in the 90s that took away our guns. It was the Liberal government in the 2000s that jacked up our immigration intake to the kind of contemporary levels for the first time. In the 80s, they were only bringing in around an average of 80,000 people a year. In the 90s, it was the same. But then in the 2000s, under Howard, Liberals jacked it up to 200,000 a year, and they radically expanded the student visa program and so on, and also started bringing in a much larger degree of non-white immigrants. And they kind of sold it to everyone as they were tough on illegal immigration, they were tough on boat arrivals, but actually, you know, they were horrible for, you know, the demography of our country. They radically changed it, radically accelerated the mass immigration program. It was also the Liberals under Turnbull that legalized gay marriage. So again and again and again, some of the most left-wing policy changes in recent Australian history that have really been disastrous for this country have happened under the Liberals. And so I said, at what point do we just recognize that the Liberals basically are a left-wing party? Like, what right-wing policy do they even have at this point? There is none. What nationalist policy do they have? There is none. And I also made the case that if you look at the Liberal campaign donations, their number one donor is Australia's richest Jew last financial year, Harry Triguboff, the property developer, or his company, Meriton Properties. And in an analysis that was done prior to the last election, they determined that the largest kind of single industry donor in Australia is the property industry. And the property industry dumped, you know, about, I think, like 35 million, give or take, in labor, they found, but dumped 53 million into the coalition's fund. So the property industry, the top property developer in this country, and the property industry in general, seems to think that the Liberals serve their interests even more than labor. And labor's flooding the country with immigrants, which is fantastic for the property industry because it's driving up the price of housing at everyone else's expense. So why would the Liberals change it? Why would the Liberals do anything differently? And Dutton came out last year and said, oh, we'll cut immigration by 25%. Well, immigration is already ridiculously way too high. And even Labor are promising to reduce immigration over the next few years. So it doesn't really mean much. But, you know, they're promising to cut by 25%. But why would we believe them? Why wouldn't they just lie to us? And the fact that they said they would cut it by 25%, then walked it back for months and refused to keep committing to it, and then only recommitted to it after they started falling in the polls, showed there's a promise they didn't even want to make, even though 25% is so meager and insignificant that it won't make much of an effect, because obviously they don't want to upset the property lobby that pays for their political campaigns. And then obviously we've seen the Liberals bending over backwards for the Jewish community, promising all this funding to the Jewish community, no strings attached, as they say, being complicit in attacks on hate speech at the federal level and at the state level. It was them who championed the hate speech laws that were passed at a federal level originally, and then Labor came along and matched it. And then at the state level, they voted for the hate speech laws with the Labor Party, the new hate speech laws in New South Wales. And in Victoria, Labor brought forward the new anti-vilification laws. The Liberals said that they wouldn't vote for it unless they removed the political exemption. They basically said that these laws don't go far enough. They don't trample on political speech. And that's unacceptable because the Jews, the Jewish lobby groups, they don't want to be criticized under the auspices of political speech. And so we have to ban that as well. The Labour Party then agreed to removing that from the legislation, making these laws, in my opinion, unconstitutional, but basically removing the political speech exemption to the anti-vilification laws. And the Liberals pretended to then oppose it from there, but they were responsible for making the law much worse. So the Liberals have a terrible track record on free speech, on immigration, and all the issues that matter. Yet, nevertheless, they managed to convince a very substantial portion of the country to vote for them simply because they're not Labour or they're not the Greens. So people are afraid of more Labour or more Greens, like as if that's any different, as if like a Labour government or a Liberal government is meaningfully different at this point. And that's why like the NSN were at Senator Patterson's office last weekend with a banner that said Liberal Labour Third World Australia, because that's the reality. Regardless of which government comes in, Liberal or Labour, they're going to keep flooding us with mass immigration. They're going to keep reducing white people to a minority. And they're going to keep destroying the economy, driving up the price of housing, stagnating your wages, stealing your birthright, and imposing third world conditions, not just because of import, the third world become the third world, but like literally through impoverishing Australians with their policies, because their policies are geared towards benefiting, you know, a rich elite at all of our expenses. So why, on what basis should we be voting for them? And then my argument is that traitors are worse than enemies. Liberals are ostensibly supposed to be a right-wing conservative party for patriots to vote for, yet they're offering us nothing, so they deserve to be punished. Like, obviously, Labour is not going to represent us. They're a left-wing party that is committed to left-wing values. Obviously, the Greens aren't going to represent us. They're basically a communist party. So us not voting for them or denying them our vote or our support, it really is meaningless. They're not trying to get our support, like patriotic right-wing Australians. The Liberals are, though. And what the polling has shown in recent weeks is that Liberals have been bleeding votes, not to Labour really that much. They've been bleeding all their votes to the right-wing minor parties. The right-wing minor parties are set to have their best performance ever in Australian political history. And it will cost the Liberals the election because they've not done anything for the right-wing base. And so I think we should just pile on, punish them, put them rock last. Labour's probably going to win anyway. But we need to start teaching right-wing Australians, we need to start teaching patriotic Australians to hate the Liberal Party and view them as their primary enemy, because as long as the Liberals are established as the dominant right-wing force in this country, it completely gatekeeps out any real opposition from forming. So let's destroy them, wipe them out of the way, and let's build a real right-wing, let's build a real nationalist movement in this country. So a lot of people got upset about that article, but I don't really see an argument against it.
Well, it was well written. I saw Jacob Hurston's speech at the front of that a particular minister's office as well. Good speech, really good speech. Hard to actually argue or disagree with anything he's saying. And that's good. That's what you want to do. You want to make your points virtually impossible to argue with. Easy for mass appeal. But it looked very polished and organized. The guys have really developed themselves. I know some people who are critical of the Black Bloc and always have been. And even they're saying, you know what, that looked very polished, very organized. The speech was great. But is there a way, I was thinking while you were talking, is there a way for the property lobby to make money without mass immigration? Have they considered that it might not be necessary to replace the white Australian working class with Indians in order to, you know, make a good profit from the sale of more properties or white goods or whatever it is these people are lobbying politicians to do? Can they make money without that, or is that the fastest way to make bank?
Well, obviously, it drives up demand for their product. Like, you only have a certain amount of property. You can't choose. I mean, I guess you can choose to be homeless, but that's not really a good option. So everyone has to live somewhere. So if you have more people chasing after less properties, obviously that makes the value of property go up, and it creates demand to build new properties. So if the population from the beginning of this century, from the year 2000 to now, the Australian population has increased almost 9 million people, which is almost a 50% increase which I believe in all Western countries is like the highest population increase. And that's all driven by immigration because we've had a below replacement birth rate for most of that time period. So immigration has basically driven the country to add an extra 9 million, mostly brown or various non-white people. They haven't built 9 million people worth of houses. And so that means over the last 25 years, as everyone who lives in Australia knows, property prices have radically spiked, where now the average house price in Sydney is like $2 million. I mean, that's insane. $2 million. That's the biggest city in Australia, home to 6 million people. The average
How do
house
you
costs
bring
two
that
million.
price down, though? How do you bring that price back down to make housing affordable for Australians of our generation, for example? What's the first thing you do?
Well, it's simple, demand and supply. So there's two ways of doing it. You increase the supply, you reduce the demand. Reducing the demand means reducing how many people are in the country. Increasing supply means building more houses. Now, building more houses takes time. And actually, the housing industry in Australia is, I think, the largest portion of our
But
economy
why
relative to
then?
the Western
If
country. Well,
it
let me
takes time,
explain it
you're
for a
right,
second.
like building more houses takes time, but why then is the government trying to shove so many more migrants into the country when the houses don't exist? Who's benefiting from that?
Well, basically, people who are property developers benefit the most, but there's other benefactors as well, which are people who own investment properties. Their
But if the
investment
housing isn't
increases
there, if
in
the
value.
housing isn't there, how's the property lobby benefiting? They'll benefit in the future when the houses are there to sell.
No,
But is
when
it
they're
creating
building.
such a demand for properties that people are willing to tolerate any and all conditions in rental situations
Well, they
because
can
there's
charge
nowhere
more.
else to
You
rent?
can simply charge more. So they've got land. So you're developing land. Well, it costs X amount to build each house. But if you bring in 500 million immigrants over the next year, it means property prices will go up and you'll be able to sell those houses for more. But they've put the same amount of resources into building them. There's also other benefactors in the business lobby because mass immigration is also stagnating wages. We saw during COVID when the borders were shut basically for 2 years, a year and a half, that rents actually stabilized and started going down, and wages experienced their largest growth of any time period in recent history because there was no immigration. So there's a lot of inflation. Like every year you get X percent of inflation, everything's getting more expensive. Your wages, you will notice if you get paid a wage, are not going up as quickly as the cost of everything, whether it be cars, houses, food, whatever, electricity. All your bills, all your expenses are growing faster than your wages. And so people have less money to save. People are struggling more and more. Everyone notices this, and it's just a basic economic graph that I could
Do
go
you
pull up
think
and be
it's
boring. It's
do you think
real.
this is
But the main
driven?
thing driving that is immigration. The main and the thing is what's who's benefiting from that? As I said, the either the businesses that are paying less to their workers, or it's property developers who are making properties, or property investors who already own a whole series of properties. So they're all benefiting. Who's suffering? People who have to buy a house, a new house, people who have to rent, and people who work. That's who's
Is it
suffering.
greed or ideology? What's the primary motivation here from
Greed.
these lobbyists and property? Is it greed or is it ideology?
It's
Is it a bit of
definitely
both?
greed.
Yeah.
I think in politics it's a bit of both because there's other elements in politics that are explicitly anti-white that are driving our demographic replacement, right? For racial reasons.
Well, typically, politics would exist, your politicians, your statesmen would exist in order to limit the damage that the greed of the financial sector can do to your country. But instead of limiting it or restricting it or even supervising it, they're feeding into it. They're part of that greed system, right? So basically, their position now is not only like worthless for our benefit, but it's actually harmful to us. The role they're playing in all this, our statesmen, our elected officials, as we refer to them, it's actively harmful to us, to our country, and to our standard of living, right?
Well, yeah, obviously. But the point, though, is that the reason why I describe all of this is that, the They would easily be able to win the election, Liberals, if they just said, we're going to cut immigration, we're going to cut it to net zero, we're going to bring the cost of housing down, and we're going to make it so that young people, it's easier for them to buy a home, and that we're going to stabilize the housing market. But they don't want to burst the bubble because there's too many wealthy interests that want to keep that bubble going that would lose out, even though the average Australian would win out. And there's also a lot of people who have mortgages who go, well, we don't want the housing bubble to be popped because I've got a mortgage on this really expensive property. If that property is now worth half, well, I lose all my equity and that's going to screw me over. Which is why the only real way to solve this, as I've said many times, is not just cutting immigration, but actually deporting people, particularly temporary visa holders, just cancel their visa renewals and send them back and don't bring more in. There's like 2.5 to 3 million temporary visa holders in Australia. Just cancel pretty much all their visas. Stop letting people in. Boom, house prices are going to start coming down. Rents are going to start coming down. And everyone's quality of life is going to increase a lot. But there's going to be some people who just borrowed money from the bank to buy a super expensive house that is now worth, you know, 20, 30, 40% less. They're going to be like, well, what about me? Which is why I think it needs to be paired with a nationalization of the banking system and debt forgiveness. And actually, historically, that sounds extreme, but historically, debt forgiveness was actually quite normal. They used to have like a jubilee, as they called it, in a lot of ancient civilizations, every X amount of years, every 49 years or whatever, all the debts would get wiped. And that was just like a standard practice. So every 7 years, every 49 years, whatever. And that's actually what you need in a system that accrues debt. Because the thing is that debt keeps compounding if you don't ever kind of wash it out. Because, you know,
but what's the point of ever repaying your debts if that's the situation? Why would you ever repay your debt if it's all just going to be wiped eventually anyway? Or is it only partially wiped?
Well, you need to service your debt. You need to service your debt. Otherwise, you default on it. But in this situation, it'd be a one-time thing. If you build the system more stably, you don't need to do this too often. But when you build it, I think Australia has the highest percentage of household debt of any Western country. We have had the fastest, as a raw percentage, population expansion in recent decades. And we also have like the highest house prices of like any country, basically. So it's like when you get yourself into this much of a problem where you have to bring prices down, but everyone has borrowed money to pay these ridiculous prices, there's no real way out of that mess except for forgiving and canceling debts. So the thing is that the banks, when they issue mortgages, they don't have the money sitting there that they lend to you. They literally invent it. Like they basically print the money. Well, they don't print it because there's no cash, but they just like write it in a computer system. The central bank gives private banks. Supply. Yeah, they give private banks the ability to create money out of nothing in the form of debt. So it's not like they're owed per se. And if you nationalize the banks, you could basically, you know, you could basically buy out all of the shares, and then the shareholders don't stand to lose anything. So you wouldn't destabilize the financial system. And then you just start canceling people's debts. And then you kind of have like some kind of system of determining how much debt cancellation to do. Like
if the money's created from nothing, would that mean if I go and steal money from someone now, it's not technically stealing anything because the money's not backed by anything. So I haven't committed a crime. Well, I'm getting ideas here. I'll think about this in private.
I think the point to though is that the system is bullshit anyway. Like money is a social construct. It isn't backed by anything real. So we can arbitrarily decide as a society to restructure the distribution of money. Like we don't have, like there isn't like some moral law that says, oh, that's bad to like forgive people's debts. You could even say that it's immoral to charge debts at interest, particularly when the money is being printed from nothing. The interest rate basically is modulated because banks would be, even if they had an interest rate of zero, banks would still make profit because they print the money out of nothing anyway. So if I create $100 out of nothing and I give it to you and I say, give me back $100 over the next 10 years, I'm getting $100 for nothing, right? So I don't even need to charge you interest. But they changed the interest rate basically to try and speed up or slow down how much money is in the system to control inflation. That's the only reason why interest rates fluctuate. So anyway, the point is that that's the only way to do it. That's the only way to actually fix the problem. We should like be trying to halve house prices, or even better, like we should be trying to crater them. And then if you just forgive the debts of everyone who's mortgaged up to own their own home, you've got a lot of people who have investment properties. I wouldn't be forgiving their debts. I would say sell your fucking investment properties, too bad. Pay off your debts that way. But people who
But what
are
if their
basically taking
investment property is going to serve as their superannuation? That's all they've got. Then you're taking everything they've ever worked for.
Everything has winners and losers. Right now, young people in Australia can't afford to buy homes. So that's what's the central concern. If you've got people that have like three investment properties and they're charging rents on all these investment properties that they've taken out loans at the bank for, and then we create a house prices, well, okay, that means that you're not going to be as rich, but you're in a position where you
No,
can
no, no,
take
no,
it.
no, no. Wait. Boomers need to go on their luxury cruises, man. We can't take that away from them. They need to go
People
and
accuse
enjoy
me of
life.
like, oh, Joel, you're a communist because of having these ideas. No, it's just about think about it rationally. So what are we going to do? We're just going to have a society where no one can afford to buy a house under the age of 40 because otherwise we'd be communists. Oh, they're going to call me a communist. This isn't communism anyway. This is national socialism. It's not communism. I'm not saying we should abolish private property. What I'm saying is that we should basically make it possible for young Australian families to own their own home. We should have an objective in society for basically everyone to own their own home. We shouldn't have so many people renting. Particularly, you're going to have a certain amount of renting, but you should basically have a society that's geared around the average person being able to own their own dirt. And then the fluctuation in house prices don't even matter so much if you don't have debt on it. Basically, you just own your own dirt, you own your own property, and that's that. You don't have to pay a mortgage, you don't have to pay a rent. You just live there and it's yours. That should be the society that we're aiming towards. Not everyone paying a mortgage or everyone paying a rent. That's exploitative. And then all of that money that people are earning, that is basically flushing down the toilet in rents and mortgage repayments, and they can use it to buy stuff. And then what you're going to
This is
do is going
across
to create
the board,
jobs,
though,
and
isn't it?
you're going to create a much healthier economy for everyone, and that everyone will be doing much better. We have a giant
Well, that
amount of
sounds
parents,
like
and like the portion of people's incomes that they spend on mortgages or rents is ridiculously high. It's never been this high basically in history. I don't think even in human history. Like, it's crazy the way the system is organized. It needs to be radically
whole
restructured.
economy is transforming into a subscription-based economy. It's like you don't own anything anymore. You only rent the right to use something for a limited period of time. For example, right? You buy your own car, right? And you own the car. You paid a lot of money for the car. In Australia, cars are expensive. You'll pay upwards of $20,000 for a decent vehicle that's going to last you any, notable amount of time. And but you need to pay a subscription to the government to be allowed to drive it on the government's roads. And you have to have a license. That's normal, that. But that yearly registration payment is like an annual subscription to use something that you already bought and service yourself to get to the job you go to pay the government your tax subscription in order to legally exist. So it's a subscription on top of a subscription there. And that's just a car. We're not even getting into software, entertainments. Gym memberships and stuff like that. Everything's subscription based now. You used to be able to buy Windows or Windows products like Word and PowerPoint. Now you pay a subscription service and you never have any ownership right to it. You're only renting the rights to use it temporarily until you have to pay again later. And have you noticed that everything started to develop down that line? Music. Like, can you buy music now? You can still get CDs and stuff like that. And what most people do, though, is they buy the right to rent access to music through apps like Spotify or YouTube Music. Again, that's a demonstration of how, in a very short time, we've moved to an economy where you can own things. You can own things that people are creating and producing and selling. No longer can you do that. In the future, you won't even have an option to do it. It'll just be you rent the right to access it temporarily And then you keep paying for the same thing that you already paid for previously. Yeah.
Well, I mean, in terms of like music subscription, I don't think that's so bad. I mean, it's a lot cheaper to just have a Spotify subscription than to buy every single album that you would want to listen to.
It's true too, because they do get wrecked too, don't they? Like when you used to have CDs, you'd lose them, you'd damage them, and then suddenly they weren't valuable anymore. They weren't worth what you paid for them, really. So yeah, I get that. That's only one. But it's tying into a broader aspect of a transforming economy. I think
with housing, though, it's more fundamental, because that's like, for most people, it's the most expensive thing most people own. And it's the biggest cost. And it's also like important. Like, basically, where you're going to live, what are you going to eat, how are you going to get around? These are like the three most important things. And obviously cars are a lot cheaper than houses, and food are a lot cheaper than houses. So really, housing is really where they get you. That's where it's difficult. And we used to live in a society where the average person didn't just own their own home, but they had paid off their mortgage. Like, that was like how it was in Australia in the 1950s. Like, you're in your mid-30s and you've paid your mortgage off. Like, who in their mid-30s has paid off their mortgage and owns their home out right now? Like, literally nobody. Like,
they haven't even paid off the interest. They haven't even made a dent in the interest by the time they're 30.
Yeah.
And that's if they're lucky enough to actually have succeeded in securing a loan. Because most people in their 30s, or even in their 30s, even 10 years ago, would struggle to get approved for a loan to buy a house. Now it's impossible.
Yeah. And then also, a lot of people who own investment properties, they don't even own those investment properties outright. They go and get a loan from a bank. They don't even own their own home outright. And then they go, well, in order to make my repayments on my property easier, I'll loan even more money and I'll buy an investment property, and then I'll get the rent to pay that repayment, and then I'll increase my equity. And that'll then ultimately be like...
Imagine if a law came in, Joel. Imagine if we made a law that you couldn't rent any property that you didn't own yet. You had to completely own it. Wouldn't that transform the situation quickly?
Yeah, but obviously under the current situation, it would just make a lot of people homeless. They just couldn't afford to buy it. So, but yeah, obviously there's a lot of people who come in and they buy up homes. That's the other thing as well. Speculation bids up the price of housing. But yeah, look, I'm not saying that we should ban renting or ban people renting properties to people. That can be convenient, but we should have a system that makes it easy for people to own their own homes. But instead, we have a system that tries to exploit you for trying to live somewhere, trying to suck parasitically as much blood, sweat, and tears out of you as it possibly can through your whole life so that you have somewhere to live. And it's a disgusting way to organize a society and an economy, and it needs to be radically changed. That's the core issue. Everything kind of in Australia, it's the question of, on the existential, the macro level, do we have a homeland? Is this our home? Australia, does it belong to us, or does it belong to the world? Does it belong to anyone who just showed up 5 minutes ago? And then on the micro level, can we actually have a home? And these two issues are intimately connected, because mass immigration is the primary driver of making us homeless in the micro and the macro, and make us basically a serf class, like reducing our... We honestly treated worse than serfs in medieval Europe in many respects. Serfs in medieval Europe couldn't be evicted by the lord or the baron or whoever they were answering to, the duke. They were just literally, they basically had the right to live there their whole life. It's just that when they went and farmed, they had to give X percent of what they produced to the big guy. That was the deal.
Hey, but at least we have cappuccinos and Kathmandu jackets. So we're doing better in some respects.
Yeah, you could say that, but I mean, like, people think that, oh man, back in the day when you had like lords and ladies and the aristocracy and serfdom, oh, they had it tough back then or whatever. Honestly, you could even argue that the slaves had it going on better. Like the slaves weren't getting evicted from the cotton fields in the American South. All they had to do was go out all day and like pick some cotton. Now it's like, all right, we'll give you, $25, $50 an hour, and tell you to fuck off at the end of the day, and you can go figure out how to go and pay some exorbitant mortgage to like some Chinese investment property owner. Or you can pay the mortgage, of a Chinese investment property owner with exorbitant rents. I mean,
It's not very dignifying, is it?
No. So that's kind of where
how can you expect the people put in that kind of living situation to have any sort of respect for themselves? And I don't think elitists, I don't think lobbyists, I don't think people of the political class really care whether or not they have a self-respecting population. They just don't care about the people. That much is clear. Not only is our economy becoming subscription-based, but our society is becoming just exploitative. It's like if you want to succeed, you exploit, you take advantage. It's very mercantile. No longer is there honor, respect. And I suppose one of the reasons I align myself with nationalism is to, you know, revive some of that respect, that honor between each other, amongst each other as a community. Because, you know, I just don't like the way society's going, obviously.
Yeah, but anyway, on the election itself, I do think there just needs to be a kind of mass recognition on the Australian right that the Liberals are our primary enemy. Like, at least the left have some kind of ideological reason for fucking us over. Liberals don't. Liberals are just pure prostitutes. They're just a whore for whatever special interest group is going to pay for their policies. At the moment, it's Jews and property developers and so on. And so those are the policies they have. So why are you voting for this? Why are you giving this any support whatsoever? Like, it doesn't deserve any support. They deserve to lose. And the narrative from this election is going to be that they've lost not because the left wing won the argument, but because there's no right wing, really. Or, you know, they're basically going to lose the election to the right. Their base is not going to vote for them, the traditional base, and is instead going to go and vote for Clive Palmer's meme party or One Nation or Gerard Rennick or the Libertarians or whatever other, you know, minor party. And they're probably going to do the best that they've ever done in Australian political history. And that's great, because we want to set up another right-wing minor party ourselves, and we want a section of that vote. So it's great to see. I hope the Liberals get absolutely destroyed at the next election, and everyone should preference them last. And to all these, like, annoying conservatives who say, oh, well, then you're just going to be complicit in Labor getting elected. Well, no, actually, it's the Liberals that are going to be responsible for Labor getting elected, for basically refusing to do anything actually nationalist or right-wing that the people that would otherwise have voted for them would want. Not doing anything to actually deserve winning. It's their fault. It's not my fault for having an opinion on the internet. And the other thing about the Liberals as well is that if you look at it, the polling data, they're a boomer party. So, like, people over the age of 65, more than half of them vote for the Liberals. But by the time you get to people under the age of 35, it's like only a quarter of them are voting Liberal. So they've completely lost the young generation. And as all the boomers die off, they're going to have no base. And the only people who vote for the Liberals basically are white guys, more or less, or white people. And they're losing white people. All the young whites are either going to go to the Greens if they're lefties, or they're going to go to Labor if they're brown, or they're going to go to the right-wing minor parties if they're right-wing, and the Liberals are going to be a dying brand.
So it's probably good. Probably a good thing. I mean, we need to, as we discussed in the last stream, we need to become more ideologically focused rather than voting for statesmen that, you know, just have dollar signs in their eyes. They're just getting money put in their pockets by these lobbyists that don't give a shit about Australia. They just want to make money by exploiting the situation. But it's Good Friday, by the way. So happy Easter, everyone. I hope everyone enjoys their weekend. We've got a bit of a thing planned for the weekend. Me and some friends. Joel's coming along too, I think. So we'll be busy as of tomorrow. But for that reason, actually, I suggested that we kind of wrap the stream up somewhat early, because we've got a very early start in the morning. But we'll see how we go. We'll get to about 10 o'clock and then see how things are looking. So if you want to get a super chat in, you want to get it in before 10.
Well, Aussie Autist 88 said, Blair, what's your favorite Pokemon?
I always like the ghost types. with the psychic abilities like Gengar, Alakazam. I liked their ability to manipulate the situation to their advantage, and the fact that they were a little bit mysterious. But I only know the original 151 Pokemon. I only know Season 1 because that's what I grew up with. Anything
you know
other
pretty
than
well.
That,
you know there's 151, so you know that you must.
Oh,
know
mate, anything well. Other than that, get it the fuck out of here. I don't want to know about any other Pokemon. There's 151 OG from Season 1. Nothing else exists. Yeah, so I'd have to say the ghosts and psychic types. I like those ones the best. What about you, Joel? What's your favorite Pokemon?
I don't really have an opinion.
Come on, man. You didn't watch Pokemon? What did you watch? What was your childhood cartoon?
Dragon Ball Z. What was the Dragon Ball
favorite
Z?
Favorite character. Kid? Favorite character.
Dragon Ball Z? Really? Probably. That's a hard one. Vegeta was the funniest character, I thought.
Funny? That's an interesting perspective of Vegeta. He's a very serious character.
Yeah, but I kind of appreciated him because of like the whole narcissism thing. But also Boo was probably the most dynamic character.
Right, because he's like has multiple forms, can't be easily destroyed, hard to predict. Yeah, I can see why you would like him. I thought Frieza or Cell one of my favorite villains. But yeah, as I said, guys, it's Good Friday, so it's just a relaxed kind of stream. Well, that was my interpretation of what this was going to be going into it. We've got another one or two talking points, though, I believe. What's next on the agenda, Mr. Davis?
Well, see, Liam Four said, has Blair ever watched Archaics on YouTube? He's asked some cosmic questions on previous streams, and I think he would be into it. The channel has some good new videos about Jewish exiles. That's kind of funny that you asked that, because I literally watched that guy's channel for the first time today myself. I don't know if Blair's heard of this guy, but...
Well, there you go. You're probably more equipped to answer the question than I am, because I don't think I know the channel. No. I do find I seem to be paraphrasing a lot of stuff that other people, you know, that are into philosophy or ideology, they talk about it. But I think it's just because I maybe instinctually or intuitively understand it without having actually looked into it. Because when you're aligned with a certain philosophical process of thought, you tend to pick up on things and understand things instinctively as a result of your alignments. So, like, I don't actually absorb a lot of content from other people. Most of the stuff I believe is a result of my own observation of society generally.
Yeah, well, the video that I watched, he was talking about the origins of Freemasonry, and he basically had a theory that Freemasonry, or like not Freemasonry proper, but like the precursors of Freemasonry were established by Jews in exile after they were wiped out in the mid-second century BC, or after, like, because obviously you have in 70 AD the defeat of Judea by the Romans, but they a lot of the Jewish population didn't live in Judea at the time. And so a lot of them moved back and continued struggling. And then they were kind of defeated ultimately under Hadrian's rule, I believe, in, I think, 135 AD, something like that. And so his theory was that the mid-second century AD, that they had to adapt and figure out how to wield power as a diaspora, how to wield power outside of having their own state now that Judea was gone. And that was where the precursor to Freemasonry kind of style secret societies were formulated. And then he went through all of these kind of parallels between Freemasonic, concepts and Jewish mysticism and so on. So it was pretty interesting. But it was just one video. He didn't really like fully defend his entire thesis. He just discussed elements of it, but it was pretty interesting. He seems like it's an interesting YouTube channel for that reason. He's able to call out the Jews like that on YouTube and get away with it. So, and Spartan Sarduka said, eat raw chopped up garlic at least once a week. It kills off parasites and helps immunity. Food is medicine. Pumpkin seeds and papaya seeds also help to expel parasites. But all three don't work on Jews.
I don't know if it was a parasite. Maybe it was. It just seemed like it was pretty contagious, though, because few of my mates had it as well, and they all reacted similarly. So I'm pretty sure it was maybe a strain of norovirus. Those were what the symptoms were leading me to believe it was, but I'm not really sure. But you know what I do when I've got an irritation in my sinus, which I often get, because my sinuses are particularly susceptible to irritation. They're like twice the size they should be. I think I've said it on another stream, as a result of breathing in so much silica dust and other chemicals on construction sites. Because fucking, you know, you don't need a mask, you little bitch, get this done. You know, that's the way the culture is out in the suburbs. And I used to stick actual garlic cloves. Like I'd peel two raw garlic cloves and shove them up my nose. And that would just make everything pour out. It burned, but it worked. Garlic's good. It's kind of magical for that kind of thing, like a natural antibiotic.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I like garlic. I think it's, you're attracted to, I trust in my body. You're attracted to flavors. Like whenever, but that's the thing. He's saying here to have raw chopped up garlic when I've really only really consumed garlic when it's cooked, basically. I do love the smell when it's in the pan, like some onion or something.
Do you follow a specific type of diet, or do you just kind of eat whatever you feel like you want to eat? What's your diet like?
Just eat a lot of meat and drink a lot of milk. I like fish. I have a lot of seafood as well. But yeah, I just don't really believe in having too much like non-animal products. I don't have a carnivore diet. Like I do eat vegetables and potatoes and bread and stuff like that, but I just try not to have too much of it because I don't think it's doesn't make me feel good. I don't really feel satisfied, whereas when I eat meat and dairy, it makes me feel satisfied. I've also found a fish and chip shop recently that they fry the fish and chips in tallow. We actually went there the other day, and that's been a revelation because I've always been a huge fan of the classic Anglo fish and chips, but the seed oils are horrible. But if they deep fry it in beef tallow, well, it's no longer anywhere near as bad for you. And it basically tastes great, maybe better, I would say, but it doesn't make you feel that kind of like yuck feeling that consuming a lot of deep fried seed oil foods gives you. If you really pay attention to your body, I feel like most people report feeling that. So
you got to remember a lot of the wheat from the bread that you eat these days is genetically modified to make it grow faster. And there's been some studies that have suggested, studies that I've read online, that that genetic modification causes the gluten content, which is the binding protein, to increase dramatically. And that might be why a lot of people are, throughout society, a lot of people now are developing gluten intolerance and celiac disease, because the gluten in the bread, in the wheat flour, is just like, the amount of it is ridiculously high as a result of the, you know, genetic tampering with the way the wheat grows. So, but bread previously, I think, was a bit of a peasant food because it fills your stomach and it eliminates the feeling of hunger, and it's a fast absorbing carbohydrate, yet it doesn't really provide any like, you know, important nutritional value to your body. It's not really got any source of absorbable protein that's going to have a notable effect on muscle repair. Yeah. Or, you know, all the other things that protein is converted into, like serotonin and dopamine and so forth. So I think for that reason, I've always dubbed breads, pastas, grain-based foods like that as peasant food, because they're kind of just a staple to get rid of hunger until you find real food. Whereas, you know, if you consider the diets of the upper class, the aristocrats, they wouldn't have been sitting there eating bread, right? They would have had, you know, meats, animal proteins, fish. You know,
I eat a lot of fruit as well. I didn't mention that, but fruit I think is fantastic. So full of vitamins, and I probably consume too much, some people would say, but it makes me feel good. So I just kind of listen to my body.
That's definitely real. That's the best way. That's the best way to be, I've found too, to listen to your body. There's actually no structured or restrictive diet, whether it's carnivore. I remember that paleo thing came in for a while. And there's the ketosis diet. The main reason you'll feel better on restrictive diets that only allow you to eat certain amount, types of food isn't really because those foods are good for you so much as what you're excluding is beneficial for your system. What I mean is, for example, if you're following the carnivore diet, you're not going to be feeling better. You'll usually feel better within a week of eating nothing but meat or beef. You'll feel better, but it's not necessarily because the beef is that good for you. Beef's good for you, but that's not necessarily why you're feeling better. You're feeling better because of what you're eliminating. You're not eating processed foods, packeted foods, preservatives, and all those things on the ingredients list that are revised by a number like 203 or 204 or something like that. You know, acidity regulators and emulsifiers. Not eating those things is making you feel better. So yeah, red meat, while it's good for you, it's really not why you feel better. And I think it all just comes down to trial and error. I think people should keep a food diary personally and write down what foods make them
cheap out as well. A lot of people just cheap out, try to save money, eat lower quality meat, like they'll get like the non-grass fed beef or
the sugar, man. Sugar is really cheap ever since the sugar tariffs back in the 70s or 80s.
It's your health. That's like one area where you shouldn't be cheaping out. You should be investing in your own health, because that's ultimately the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, like as you were saying, listen to your body. Like, spend some time getting off the sugar and the processed foods if that's a problem for you. And you just start with the basics. You start with fish, beef, chicken, rice, oats, maybe a couple of your favorite fruits. And, you know, process of elimination. You can add things in here and there, but if it doesn't make you feel good, you cut it out. But what I just mentioned, that list of foods, yeah, that's where you want to start.
Yeah. Yeah, so I wanted to talk about this. I posted about it on Telegram today, this Pauline Hanson tweet. I'll read it out because, I mean, I guess you could say it's good that Pauline Hanson is saying something in defense of white people. She used to do this more, and obviously an election is coming up, so now, you know, an effort is being made to pander to the base. And yeah, we've made it, our feelings known on this show many times. We're no fans of the One Nation Party. Obviously, they're a lot better than the Liberals, but in my opinion, they're probably a liberal front in some capacity, a liberal op that's designed to basically keep the parties to the right of One Nation pacified. Sorry, to the right of the Liberal Party pacified. Because they just don't, they're just almost like intentionally dysfunctional, intentionally incompetent. They don't really run campaigns. You know, I had some friends, you know, try to sign up to the One Nation Party to say, hey, like, I've signed up, I'm a member, how can I, you know, get involved in the campaigns? They don't get any calls back. And this is a perpetual thing. I heard reports of this up in Queensland. The state election, same thing. It's like they don't really try to win. but they have a legacy brand. They're relatively popular, but they don't build on it and do anything with it. And then they run a whole bunch of Indian candidates thinking that's not going to piss off their base. Like, who do you think's voting for you? But anyway, this is what she said. Oh, that's the other thing. The thing that makes you think that they're a Liberal Party op is how they never attack the Liberals. They only ever attack Labor and the Greens, which is quite suspicious. And Pauline Hanson even came out when the election was called and said that she wants Peter Dutton to become Prime Minister. So, you know, the complete wrong mentality. I don't like Clive Palmer particularly, but I saw that he came out and attacked Liberals, saying Liberal Labor, they're both the same. We're going to preference the Liberal Party last in our how to vote cards. Basically copying the NSN rhetoric from last weekend, which was kind of funny. But yeah, like that's how a more genuine populist party would function. They would try and attack the Liberals and try and win votes off the Liberals. That's where they're going to win votes. You're not going to win votes off Labor and the Greens. But anyway, Pauline Hanson says here, you hear Labor and the Greens talk about white privilege, but never about this. In Campbelltown, Tasmania, there's a convict brick trail that tells the real story. Each brick carries the name of a convict, one of nearly 200,000 men, women and children sent here from 1788 onwards. They were white, they were poor, and they were punished for trying to survive, torn from their homes, shipped across the world, beaten, imprisoned, worked to the bone. So much of modern Australia was built on their backs, their pain, their sacrifice. But their story is being wiped from the history books because it doesn't suit the narrative. That's a disgrace. Next time someone throws around the term white privilege, show them these bricks. because this country was built from these bricks. And, you know, on the one hand, you could say, like, you can see the sentiment, like, it is true that this idea that white people have just had everything handed to us is false. And Australia is a great example of that. We showed up here on the other side of the world and we built a country out of nothing. And a lot of the people who came here were convicts or were free settlers who came here with nothing and built the country, built one of the greatest countries in the world. So that's not privilege. That's hard-won. That's sacrifice. That's hard work. That's struggle that produced the fruits that is modern Australia that are now being stolen from us. So she got a point there, but I just really hate this whole trying to portray things. You have to portray yourself as a victim in order to be legitimate, like this victim Olympics. Like, you thought Aboriginals had it tough, or you thought this group had it tough. Well, white people had it tough when we were convicts too. Why do we have to justify our existence on the basis of being oppressed? I don't think being oppressed is a good thing. It's actually a bad thing. Like it's shameful, if anything. I don't think you should get special points because you were oppressed in the past. But like, what does that imply? That if you weren't oppressed, if you were victorious or dominant or free, that you somehow deserve less than the people who were oppressed or who were...
But in the West right now, the only way the existence of your ethnic sort of identity is acknowledged is if you claim that you're oppressed. It's like oppression is the way your identity is acknowledged in our society.
Yeah, and that's the problem. That's the problem. We should be able to affirm our identity on the basis of excellence, on the great things that were achieved. Australia wasn't built by convicts primarily. It was built by free settlers. There were a lot of convicts.
Yeah, the idea that everyone who came here was a criminal and they all just banded together and built a first world country in 100 years or less. Of course, that's not true.
Yeah, I mean, you could say on the one hand that that's a good story, but it's also not a good story. It's used to kind of put us down often. Oh, you guys are just a prison colony. You know, the reality is the vast majority of the people who came here, white people, were free settlers. My family came here as free settlers that I've traced. I don't know if I might have convict lineage down one family tree that I haven't been able to fully trace all the way back, but I haven't found any convict lineage. I found free settler lineage.
I reckon you might. I reckon you got a criminal bone in you. Let us know in the comments, guys. If Joel was a type of criminal or was going to commit a crime, what kind of criminal would he be? What's the most likely crime you'd find Joel Davis committing?
I do. I mean, I don't. That's the thing as well. Like traditionally in Australia, the whole Irish convict versus Anglo settler thing, that was a big controversy. That was a big tension. We're over that as a people now. We've become one people, but that was a thing. And I don't believe. I believe to be an Australian nationalist, you have to embrace both. Like you have to say that's part of our national story is the Irish convicts, well, the convicts in general, they weren't all Irish, but is the convict story and is the free settler story, it's the Irish story and it's the Anglo story. I don't think we should side with one or the other. We should embrace it all as part of our history as a nation. That's what produced Australia and we should take pride in all of it. But, you know, obviously, being a convict isn't intrinsically anything to be proud of. And, you know, we shouldn't, yeah, as I said, we shouldn't be on our knees like begging for pity. Like we've suffered too. So please let us exist. No, like we don't need to beg anyone to exist. We don't need sympathy. We don't need pity. What we need is to take our own side. We need to take care of each other. We as white Australians don't need anybody else. Actually, we can take care of ourselves. What we lack is solidarity. What we lack is fighting spirit. What we lack is honor. That's why that's why we're in the situation that we're in. It's not because we haven't made the correct moral arguments or something to make people feel sorry for us correctly. And I don't think, you know, you were saying this before. I don't think white people really like playing the victim as much as these other groups because white people inherently...
Well, we never got anywhere. Who do you play the victim to? Who do you play the victim to? Someone in authority over you who can do something about it. And who were white people supposed to complain to? When we got to Australia, there was nothing. There was just some semi-nomadic tribes, people eating each other. We had to do the work to build a civilization. The people that come here and claim victim status, they're basically complaining to us. They're complaining to white people in positions of power who can hand them something, who can do something about it, who can provide justice, as they say. So you complain to your superiors. You play victim to the people who you know and basically are acknowledging they're superior to you, right? We couldn't do that because in terms of civilization and even ethnically, you might argue, there was no one in that position, especially when we first came here. But for that reason, I think it's like woven into us to, you know, not really understand that whole state of victimhood and trying to use it to benefit or use it to our advantage, because we've never been able to do that historically as a race. We just don't do that. We build our own civilizations. Then other people come in and claim victimhood and expect help from us. We're that race. We're those people. We are the civilization builders. We don't complain. We're not the victims, never have been. We make victims by conquering and taking land if we want to, but acknowledging their victimhood has been our mistake, right? But anyway, not acknowledging their victimhood, acknowledging their claim to victimhood, because I don't even see victims as victims most of the time. But everyone's a victim now, isn't it? Being a victim is how you profit from society. Being a victim is how you exist. Being a victim is how you identify in society. But we've got a few return or suggestions. When I asked what kind of crime Joel Davis would commit, we've got here forgery. I don't know why this person thinks forgery would be a Joel Davis crime. Theft of our hearts. Nazi salute. Pinching loaves of bread. Speeding. Speeding is not really a crime, is it? It's more just like a... is speeding a crime or is it just like a social mishap? I wouldn't know how to categorize speeding. Yeah. I don't know. Which out of those wins, Joel? What do you think? You do have a lot of speeding fines, right? Oh, well, I shouldn't probably say that on a live stream. Joel's a law-abiding citizen.
Yeah,
what's privateering? What's privateering? What's that? Privateering. Someone says privateering. Is that like being a mercenary?
It is the practice of privately owned armed vessels being commissioned by a government to attack enemy ships during wartime.
Based.
What a crime, yeah. Is it?
Yeah, I know. That's kind of a duty, isn't it? That's a duty rather than a crime. Yeah. Can someone ban this blue carbon dude? He's asking the same shit that some shill subversive is always asking. But yeah, thanks for joining us, guys, and thanks for keeping the chat active and interesting. I sometimes love to look over and see what you guys are talking about and join in the conversation. It's part of what makes this stream so entertaining for me.
Yeah, but we're on a point. I don't remember what it was now. It's kind of like a chill stream tonight. I guess it's Good Friday. It's supposed to be a somber mood. It's a somber mood, and I'm feeling that energy. But I guess another like aspect to what I was saying before, though, about how white people don't like to be victims is, you know, I think white people like to have, they like to own it. They don't just, and that's kind of like what it means to not be a parasite. You want friends to take care of you, but you want to own it because you take care of them. You do your part. You want them to do their part. That's what makes a society. And that's what makes a movement. You know, in politics, the politics of the Liberal Party or the politics of pretty much all the other major parties is not really built around like genuine friendship. It's not built around a genuine ideology. It's basically a confidence game. It's a set of, well, what's going to work well with voters is we're going to say things like this, we're going to say things like that, we're going to cut deals with these people, we're going to cut deals with those people. It's like horse trading. It's manipulation. They don't really like have each other's backs. Like, I don't think the people in the Liberal Party or the people in the Labor Party like really respect each other or like each other, or every single one of them would burn every single other one of them if it ever became politically expedient to do so. They don't really have loyalty or brotherhood. They're not really working towards some like ultimate grand vision they're just trying to advance themselves as professional politicians within the framework of the Liberal Party or the Labour Party or whatever.
How do you manage people like that? I think you manage people like that through self-gain and fear of consequence. It's the only thing that moves people like that.
Yeah, exactly. But that kind of bleeds down to the whole country, where the whole country no longer really has any sense of solidarity, where the whole country is just kind of everyone trying to get their slice of the pie. And so, yeah, there isn't really like, you know, I think the way it felt for boomers when they were growing up or whatever, like back in the day, was a certain sense of like doing things the right way, and that, like, you know, we live in a society, you know, if you play by the rules, you get rewarded, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't feel like that anymore. It feels like there's not really much loyalty, particularly with young people, to any aspect of the system. Everyone, I notice when I'm out shopping, everyone is shoplifting. There's graffiti everywhere. People don't let you in when you try to change lanes in traffic. People don't wave. People don't say hi to you on the side of the street. Everyone is in this kind of very hostile orientation. I guess that's what you get with diversity. But this kind of basic premise of taking care of each other or whatever, like, it seems almost ridiculous, but that's really what politics is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about taking care of each other. It's supposed to be about taking care of your friends, fighting your enemies. Now instead it's like kind of like this professional like stage show, but it's really badly performed. No one really knows how to do it very well. And it just kind of becomes which one of these performances are you more like disgusted by, basically? And that determines like what side of the political aisle you're on. Does that feel like that to you as well? Or
absolutely. What really resonates with me is when you were talking about how traffic conditions have changed, how rude and belligerent everyone is on the road now. Oh my God, man. I am really often, too often, on the verge of, I shouldn't even finish the sentence in order not to like incriminate myself. But look, let me put it to you this way. Politically, I'm no threat to anyone. When I'm in a car in that traffic, especially in like peak hour traffic, work traffic, being tailgated, cut off, taken advantage of, even though I'm trying to allow space, I'm trying to be good to everybody. You know, because I grew up in a country where this around us now wasn't happening. I grew up in a time, I learned to drive in a time where people actually were a bit more considerate of each other. Man, when I'm in that situation, that's when I'm a danger to society, whenever I'm behind the wheel. Not because I drive erratically, but because everybody else drives erratically and I want to punish them for it. And you can really feel the lack of cops too, lack of police out there. Mm. It's rare that you see any traffic cops now. You used to see them all the time 5-6 years ago. Now you have plenty. Everyone's running red lights. I see it several times an hour now. It's like the only way people feel like they're getting anywhere as a result of how bad the traffic is. I won't get into it in much more detail. All I'll say is it's extremely irritating to be in Australian traffic conditions right now. Curiously though, last comment, when I was in England, even though the traffic, you know, the volume of people on the road was probably greater than it is here in Australia, and the roads were smaller and more frustrating to manage overall, people were kind. People would wait for you and let you in. People were patient. People were kind. And it's kind of, you know, it's a pleasant experience to drive around the English countryside specifically. But even in heavy traffic closer to London, people let you in. People wait. And my only, the only way I can understand why that is, when you come over to Australia, the roads are bigger, there's fewer people, but everyone's aggressive. Everyone's cutting you off, like you indicate, because you want to change lanes. And the person in that lane beyond your blind spot doesn't actually slow down to allow you to do it. They speed up to try to stop you from doing it, even though they can't go anywhere. It's like, why, man? I'm trying to turn right. Like, get out of the fucking way. I think the reason for it is we've had it so good in Australia for so long and we're not used to these conditions. And so we haven't been successfully crushed into just accepting it and starting to be patient enough to deal with it. So we're still hating on each other down here in Australia, but it's probably got something to do with the general social situation as you described, where everything's just about exploiting the situation to your advantage. Like whether it's economy or socially, whatever it is, everyone's just trying to exploit and get ahead of each other. And you really feel that in the traffic. You really do.
Yeah, there's like barely there's barely any authenticity left. I think that could be what we could provide the politics would be like a breath of fresh air, perhaps, is like people who actually believe in something and doing it because we actually care. It doesn't really feel like any of these other people really care. You know? Like it doesn't feel like Peter Dutton gives a shit. He's like this weird actor. You think if they're going to get like fake, like performance artists, which is basically what a politician is at this point, they get someone who's not ugly as fuck and who has a modicum of charisma, but they can't even figure out how to do that. It's bizarre. It's bizarre. That's what politics has become. It's like it's all about trying to seem likable in front of the cameras, but then Peter Dutton and Anthony Albanese are like eminently detestable. Individuals like wouldn't they? Why can't they find anyone like to
I recently reread this section of Mein Kampf where Hitler writes about parliamentarianism specifically, and his perspective on it is fantastic. I can't summarize it because I read it quickly on a plane, and I'll need to read it again and think about it in order to summarize it effectively. But I have started reading that book again because I plan to, in the near future, take the audience, our audience, my audience, through just a general summary of what the book consists of, because that book has a certain reputation which is probably undeserved in my opinion. Well, not just in my opinion, definitely undeserved, because there's nothing in that book about killing anyone. There's nothing in it about gas chambers. It's actually a pretty reasonable common sense philosophy, most of it. But yeah, specifically the section about parliamentarianism, it's very, very well broken down that it's basically degrades politics to the level of the gangster, you know, the person who's just trying to accrue power in the moment and appeal to existing sentiments in the people, but is never really trying to improve the situation of the country or really generate a new feeling in the people that's going to uplift them and produce a better outcome for their future. It's all just pick me. Parliamentarianism is all just pick me politics. And it's all just for the sake of getting picked. It's not for anything great. It's not for anything that's going to have a positive impact on the future of the country.
Exactly. Yeah, I think also that like that sentiment where you just said, oh, you know, he didn't advocate for killing anyone. It's like, well, that's the other side of politics. Politics isn't just about taking care of your people, of your friends, of your country. It's also about destroying your enemies. That's what freaks people out about National Socialism, about Adolf Hitler, is that there was a pretty uncompromising attitude that was taken towards the enemies of the German people as they saw them. And that's pathologized, but that's life. Like life, the reality of life is that anything you try to do in this world, anything you try to take or have, there's going to be someone out there that's going to try and take it off you. There's going to be someone out there trying to steal it, someone out there trying to push you down, trying to push your people down. That's just the reality. Like existence is struggle. And so if you can't come to terms with that reality, if you want to live in some like you know, idealistic fantasy land where we can all just get along and sing kumbaya around the fire holding hands, every race, color, and creed, and everyone loves each other, then you know, you're just delusional. You're delusional. That's
Do you
not
reckon
reality.
that idea of like international human equality, racial equality, you know, universal brotherhood, do you reckon that started off as a genuine idea or was it subversive from the beginning? What's your opinion?
I think it was subversive from the beginning. I think people have only really started to believe in it more recently. I think it was created originally as a marketing strategy, more or less, for one group of powerful interests to defeat another by presenting themselves as being on the side of universal morality and peace. But I think over time, people have tried to pretend to believe in this more and more, in this delusion because it makes them feel safe and secure, like a world without conflict, a world without violence, a world where everyone is treated fairly. Well, that sounds like a really nice world to live in if you're afraid of conflict.
But it also makes them seem like good people in conversation if they say they believe in those things too, right?
Exactly. Well, exactly. Yeah, you can morally grandstand, and be like, oh, see, this person who is acknowledging that he has enemies or is acknowledging that he would hurt another person under a particular set of circumstances. What a horrible piece of shit person this is. Everyone hate this guy. And it's literally that childish. It's literally that childish. But that's what we're dealing with. I saw someone, for example, on Twitter. I put out, it was in response to the noticer putting up my opinion piece. And someone was saying, oh, Joel, because I use the phrase traitor and the phrase enemy when referring to the left and referring to the Liberal Party. And he's like, well, if Joel thinks, everyone who votes for Liberal, Labor, or the Greens are either traitors or enemies, presumably he wants to execute all of us or something. And it's like, what? kind of like insane scenario are you concocting in your mind?
Well, you're not really. It's not really even on the table when the possibility of executing political opponents is on the table because you have the power and the resources to do it. Then we'll talk about that. But until then, it's just not really feasible or practical to even think about it, right? So it's not a question for the moment.
Yeah, but it's just ridiculous. So what he's basically saying is that we can't describe people as traitors or as enemies because that implies violence, and violence is bad. And Joel's a psycho lunatic. I saw people saying the same thing about Jacob Hurston's speech on the weekend because he called, he said there'll be justice for traitors and so on. People are saying, oh, this is violent. This is a threat. Is he a traitor or not? That's the real question. Like, actually defend this guy, James Patterson, this senator for the Liberal Party. When he first got elected to the Senate, he gave a whole speech about Israel. He cares more about Israel than about Australia. Who's, like... He seems like a traitor to me.
This, one of the things conservatives and like hardline leftists are doing now when they're confronted with our arguments, talking points, or just our general philosophy, which they find very hard to effectively criticize in a logical or intellectual way, they just accuse you of being violent. They just accuse you of supporting violence or, you know, through rhetoric, encouraging violence, and they try to get you shut down through that pathway. And a lot of the time they know that you're not actually supporting violence or encouraging violence, but they know how sensitive things are about that legally in the country right now. And so it's kind of like they're appealing to institutions, intelligence agencies, government bureaucrats to come down on you, to interfere and disrupt your activity, to come to your house and make your life hard. And that'll shut you up because you're making arguments that are basically infallible and they can't stand it. So it's like, stop being violent. I realize Drew Pavlou did that a lot in your debate that you had with him on. Was that on Elijah Schaefer's show?
Yeah, it was on Elijah Schaefer. But I mean, like, it's always one-sided. Like, just the other day, I shared it on my Telegram. There was an Aboriginal community leader. Let me look this up. I'll read it out. This is from the Herald Sun. An Indigenous leader who declared that non-Aboriginal Australians should, quote, go back to where you came from or, quote, face extermination, has been appointed to help lead Victoria's reconciliation efforts. In a rage-fueled online rant directed at the Prime Minister, newly appointed Aboriginal co-chair for taxpayer-funded Reconciliation Victoria, Reverend Canon Glenn Lowry, proclaimed that all non-Indigenous Australians were, quote, unworthy of welcome and residence, and bizarrely demanded that they leave the country. Quote, we, the first peoples of this land, who have given this country every opportunity to do the right thing, now declare that those who are not first people are unworthy of welcome and residence, and demand that you go back where you came from so we can heal the country and ourselves, he wrote on Facebook in February. Quote, if you fail to do so, then further steps to exterminate you, as you did and continue to do to us, may be implemented.
Oh, good luck. So what's Reverend? Guy, is Reverend, that's a Christian title, isn't it? Is that Catholic?
Yeah.
I wonder what the Catholics have to say about
that. Probably Anglican or something, yeah. Probably Anglican.
Anglican, is it? Well, yeah. I suppose with the kind of things being put out by the Anglican churches and the fact that most Anglican churches around Melbourne are being turned into 5G towers, they probably don't have much of a response But you know, imagine if this was a white reverend saying the reverse, the same but the reverse, saying that you know anyone who's not white
would be exterminated.
Imagine the response from the clergy, like from whatever institution controls or manages the Anglican churches and the reverends. Like the guy would be expelled immediately. He'd probably be on hate speech charges. He'd be before the court having to explain himself, trying to keep himself out of jail. But because the guy's black, he's Aboriginal, well, that's okay. He just made one little mistake. Let's not worry about it.
But not only that, he's been appointed co-chair of an organization called Reconciliation Victoria, about the reconciliation between Aboriginals and whites. I mean, it's laughable. It's beyond laughable. So...
And our reaction right now is demonstrative of, you know, the spirit of our race, isn't it? How we're not outraged. We're not like crying about it, and we're not declaring our victimhood, that we're a victim of this person's oppressive statements. We're laughing at him. We're laughing at him. Do you know why? Because he's neither willing nor capable of actually exterminating us. And so it's funny because the guy's of an inferior status.
Well, this is what I said on Telegram. I said, quote, as I have said many times, if the Aboriginals want a rematch, I am more than willing. Winner takes all. Let's fucking go. Clearly, reconciliation is a joke. And no matter what we do, it will never be enough. Abos need to either put up or shut up. Simple as. That's what I said.
The Anglican Church, like an Anglo-Saxon denomination or created denomination of the church. What the hell is he doing as an Anglican?
Yeah.
Did the Aboriginals have a religion of some sort? Did they have a religious practice, like Rainbow Serpent or some shit, wasn't it? I don't know.
I don't know if it's worthy of being called a religion, whatever it was they were doing, but...
Probably mushies. They're probably doing mushies and seeing things. That was their religion.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they were eating mushrooms or not, but, I mean, they were doing, you know, rituals. They had, like, a ritualistic society, as most primitive societies are organized. But, and they had, you know, myths or whatever. But, anyway, the point stands, though, which is that, like, this specter of violence, so-called, is always unidirectional. And the reality is this. If we ever are going to get close to seizing power, they're not going to just let us seize power without a fight. Like, you don't come back from this situation without a fight. We're not just going to, like, waltz in, take over the government, and then all the lefties and everyone just goes, well, you won, we lost, I guess it's your country now, we'll shut up. That's not going to happen. So a fight is what we'll end up, like, hopefully a fight is what we get. Imagine if we just get exterminated without a fight. That would be horrific through this, like, slow genocide that's happening. So we have to be willing to... There's nothing wrong with using force in defense of yourself. It's about, you know, obviously going about it the right way. Random acts of violence on the street, that's not how you go about it. But ultimately, what is the government? The government is the institutionalized use of violence. That's what it is. The government has a whole bunch of guys who work for it with guns who enforce its rules. And we want to run the government. We want to take over the government, and we want to use the government to enforce justice. And that's noble and normal and good. And everyone should want that, to live in a society like that. Because that's what a civilization is when force is used to maintain justice and order and to preserve a homeland for your people. That's how it works. So that's pathologized by idiots or disingenuous pieces of shit. And this idea that we have to reduce ourselves to just, oh, we're just discussing ideas and we don't want to hurt anyone and we love everybody and all this kind of stuff. It's nonsense. Like, that, no one is going to actually you're not going to implement anything if that's your attitude. You have to be willing to impose your will on the state, impose your will upon society if you want it to change. Otherwise, the people who are currently willing to do that, they will rule instead.
Yeah, it's just the reality of things. The way it's going. But thanks for joining us tonight, guys. We're approaching the 10 o'clock that I said I was going to check out by. I said I was going to check out at 10 because we've got an early start tomorrow morning and a bit of driving to do. So I think we've got a few more super chats to go through. The first one Katie Campbell sends $10 and says, sending you love from Canada, gentlemen. A lot of support from Canada, I've noticed. I feel like we vibe with Canadians, or they vibe with Aussies. We've got like a we've got an understanding there, maybe for similar problems, similar living standard crashing.
There's a lot of similarities between Australia and Canada historically.
But even with our general demeanor, I feel like the Canadians seem to find us amusing and I find them intelligent. Like I have this weird respect for Canadians. I'm not sure what it is. I'm not saying I like them more than Americans, although maybe I do. But I've not known that many Canadians personally, so it's hard to say. But yeah, thanks very much for the support. And Aussie Autist 88 sends through $6. It's small, but it's something. And he says, have either of you read much of Oswald Mosley's books now that you're going to start a political party instead of the most philosophy/esoteric books? I don't know what you mean by that, but have you read any of Mosley's books?
I haven't.
No, neither have I, actually. I should, though. I did learn a little bit about the political career of Mosley, but, you know, I didn't like the idea that he kind of just, not the idea, the reality that he kind of just, I don't know. I don't want to say he gave up because I don't know enough about his entire career, but he didn't have the impact that he wanted to have in the end. And I think he had some trouble with the police and that was the main reason for it, but it's worth learning about. Thanks for the recommendation. And there's a new monthly supporter to the show, Self-Sufficient Scotsman. Thanks very much, mate. And salute. What do you reckon, Joel? How are you feeling?
Friendly Fash, he said, greetings from Canada. You lads are an inspiration and the model to follow. For any aspiring nationalist organization, you've set the standard to emulate and cast a large shadow. And Blair, you're an absolute beast, but do more warm-up sets. He actually sent this after the show last week, so I'm reading it out this week because we missed it.
But hey, I do lots of warm-up sets now after I've been traumatically injured more than once. I learned the hard way, I suppose.
Yeah. But yeah, we love Canadians. We've got a great relationship with Canadians. We have the best relationship with Canadians. In fact, I'd say the best. I think Australians and Canadians, obviously there's a very similar ethnic stock origin. And the Canadian political system seems very similar to the Australian political system in a lot of ways. They have a lot of similar dynamics and issues. So it's probably one of the countries where, from a political standpoint, it makes sense for us to like pay attention to each other because there's probably a lot that we could learn from them and them from us or whatever on what works, doesn't work. But I guess there is a bit of a distinction is that the Canadians don't have that kind of like convict aggression. They're more classy Canadians.
Yeah, I get that feeling. I do get that feeling. But they have good fighting spirit nonetheless. Some of the best...
their war history is...
Some of the most notable dissident voices have come out of Canada.
Yeah, they do have a lot of pro-white representation in the movement. And also their military history is incredible. Like if you know about Canadian military history, they've been savage fighters in every major war that they've participated in. But a similar political history to Australia in many ways. Obviously the main distinction is that they have the whole French thing going on. The French being kind of part of the Canadian story and the kind of French Anglo antagonism and so on. That's unique. We don't have anything like that here or an equivalent to that here, But we love Canadians and we appreciate the support for the show. But what else have we got? Oh, and Friendly Fatch, I guess he was upset I didn't read out his super chat last week because I missed it. He said that Joel is confirmed for liking Nigs more than Canadians.
What? Where'd that come from? That's a wild card. It's a total curveball. I don't know what he means by that. Just got another $20 through from, do you want to answer that, Joel?
Oh, I mean, obviously I love niggers so much. I'm a huge nigger lover, apparently, so I think everyone can see that.
We got $20 through from your new or latest monthly subscriber, Self-Sufficient Scotsman. He says, everyone cancel your Jew flicks. and Disney Kayak subscriptions and subscribe to Joel and Rumble. Support your folk or go extinct. It's good advice.
Yeah, I don't have a Netflix, or he said Jewflix, which I guess is maybe funnier. I don't have a subscription, but a friend of mine does. And the other day, we were watching, what's that show called again, where they have like comedians come, or people come up who don't do stand-up comedy.
And they try not to laugh? They try not to laugh? Were you watching that?
It's not about trying not to laugh. It was like people who, basically anyone can put their hat, their name in a hat, and then they draw out random names.
No, it wasn't the same show I was thinking of.
I don't know how I'm forgetting the name of this show. It's like a dude's name, the host of the show.
I'm not sure what it is.
Basically it's a comedy show. They have a bunch of stand-up comedians sitting there, and then people in the audience can put their name in a hat, and then they get up and they get to do a 1 minute set. And a lot of them suck, but it's funny because then they just get roasted. They stand there and just get roasted for being shit for like 5 minutes by all the comedians. But then occasionally they do a good set, and it's a way to launch your political career. Anyway, they just moved to Netflix, and I watched the first episode of this show. And what I found interesting was how right-wing coded and racist a lot of the jokes were.
A lot of comedy is that way, though, because there's an element of truth in comedy, in good comedy. And if you're going to avoid the truth, then you're never as funny, you know.
The name of the show is called Kill Tony, everyone in the chat. Yeah, I don't know how is that missing? I'm a little off tonight. But yeah, it was interesting to observe in this episode how, now I know that, like, I think Kill Tony is kind of like conservative coded. It's kind of associated with the whole like Joe Rogan clique in American comedy. I get all of that, but it was still kind of interesting to observe how the cultural zeitgeist seems to have shifted in that space. Because have you ever been to a comedy show before,
Blair? One, Pablo Francisco, when he came to Melbourne. Do you know who that is?
No.
He does really good voice interpretations, or like what do you do like a voiceover of someone else, like a movie guy voice or something?
An impression.
He could be a voice actor. He was particularly funny. Yeah, I liked him.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to a few.
Like a lot of comedians, he was like the personification of cocaine on stage.
Yeah, I've been to quite a few comedy shows over the years, and open mic nights and things like that. Because I've had friends who were stand-up comedians or aspiring stand-up comedians. And one thing that always was very irritating was just how left-wing a lot of them were. Like, the comedy scene in Australia seems to be left-wing coded, particularly in Melbourne, obviously. And it's just not funny. Like, I've sat there and I'm like, these guys are like comedians. Why aren't I laughing? Like, surely you could make me laugh.
Like I said, though, there's an element, and comedians study this, there's an element of truth that you have to bring into your jokes a lot of the time, because sometimes what can be funny is what can be alarming to people, and what is alarming is a truth that they pass by often but don't really acknowledge because it's not socially acceptable to acknowledge it. But if you work truths like that into your gigs, they can be so alarming to the audience that they're funny, you know. So that's what I've noticed about comedy. I'm not sure if that's actually part of the study, but I could imagine it would be.
Yeah, I just think that, like, it's not really possible to be funny anymore unless you're kind of racist. Even if you walk it back and be like, oh, it was just a joke, you kind of have to, because the left wingers have become so kind of, it's such a moralistic thing, like the left wing. There's not really any space for humor there. And I think that's, you know, that's something interesting to observe, that like the culture is coming back in our direction, and that kind of plays into like the kind of round things up, why this election is kind of funny to observe. Like the opinion poll showed the Liberals were flying ahead before they called the election. It seemed like they were inevitably going to win. Everyone is kind of sick of wokeness. Everyone has like woke fatigue. Trump won in America. It feels like everything is swinging back in a conservative direction in the culture. And the Liberals responded to it by trampling all over free speech at the behest of the Jews, and then cocking out on immigration because they're, you know, basically whores for the property lobby. And then they've completely lost the whole election. And so it's kind of interesting to see how the Australian political, class totally incapable of adapting to like where the culture is going. There's this disconnect. In America, they were able to kind of capture that right-wing energy and like fuel it into some regime-compatible kind of energy. But that doesn't really seem to be happening in Australia. And a lot of European countries, it's similar. So it does seem like there's like this gap where like the culture has moved beyond politics. And if someone can figure out how to like catch politics up to the culture, they could completely kind of jam this whole system. So that gives me kind of hope in the future, I guess. But I guess we'll end it there. I hope people enjoyed the show. We've got to be up early in the morning. We've got to drive. So we'll catch you all
Happy
next
Easter,
time.
guys. Yeah, happy Easter. I hope everybody enjoys the festivities, the family stuff, the chocolate. Get into it, have some fun, let your hair down and recalibrate. We're all living tough down here in Australia these days. Things are getting expensive and hard. So take a good few days off and enjoy the weekend, guys. Love
Yeah,
you.
and also Merry Hitlertide. This year, Hitlertide begins on Easter Sunday. I don't think this will happen again until 2087. So you'll be able to celebrate Hitler's birthday and the resurrection of Christ on the same day. It's a special time. So I hope everyone enjoys a very potent, a spiritually potent Easter Sunday.
I'm not actually sure what any of that is, but oh yeah, the resurrection of Christ is what Easter's about, right? And then April 20th is Hitler's birthday, is that right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, I think I'm following. I'm sure I'll hear all about it this weekend though.
Anyway, hail victory. See you next time.